Queridos hermanos y hermanas, dear friends, as little kids, our first ideas of most professions are glamorous. Firefighters, pilots, professional athletes, police. Our family has a fond, playful memory of my youngest brother, who came over with the family to my priestly ordination in Rome, and at the age of 4, surrounded by some very prominent Vatican officials, announced that he wanted to be a garbage man. And he was very clear about that. Well, we've never really let him forget it after all these years, but it was real clear. As little kids, we think about all those different professions, and there's just something glamorous about them, whatever it may be in our heads. And only later on do we realize that there are some tough days with every vocation and every career and every profession, some challenges associated with them, some heartaches and headaches that come along. On occasion, when the St. Jude's League was active for police and firefighters, I had the chance to celebrate their annual mass, and I often would make a point of warning them against the danger of getting callous and hardened, because you'd not only see the wonderful heroic things, but you also see the underside of society, and that can be really dangerous. Or Vincentians who go out and bring charity and help to all kinds of folks. The poor are not always kind and thankful. They can be mean and angry and grasping. So can the wealthy be. So people who are active in Vincentian work have to be reminded every once in a while to have the big picture in mind, because that's important. It isn't always as glorious as it seems. Well, last week, we had that classic story of Peter as the rock. And it's important to go back there for a moment before we move into today's readings, because they go together. They're bookends. Maybe we forget that in last Sunday's gospel reading, there was an exchange of names. In other words, Jesus said to Peter, "Who do you think I am?" I asked. And Peter said, "Well, you're the Christ." And in turn, Jesus gave Simon a new name, Peter, the rock, source, foundation for the faith of the church. The point, perhaps, of last week's exchange was that we need help from other people to say who we are. It's a community endeavor. And I pondered a couple blocks away last Sunday morning at Old St. Mary's whether God has a secret name for every one of us that we don't know yet and will only be revealed when it's all over and we look back and God calls us by name and we stand up and say, "That's right, that's who we are. Never realized it, but that's who we are." Well, that was last week. This week is the other part of it, like Paul Harvey used to say, the rest of the story. And it's very important to keep this week connected to last week. You are Peter, you're the Christ, wonderful. But Jesus had to explain that it wouldn't be the Christ that Peter had in mind, which he had come to fulfill. It was not going to be simply glorious, at the head of a victorious army, just easy and simple and filled with all kinds of acclaim. It wasn't going to be a ticker tape parade down Fifth Avenue. And conversely, the job of Peter as rock would be tough, and that there would be persecution. And as a matter of fact, he didn't know it then, we do from history, that at the end of this part of the journey, he was crucified upside down in Rome as a martyr. We know the cliche says, no pain, no gain. We hear it when we're talking about things like an exercise program or a diet or weight loss or marathon training, No pain, no gain. Any kind of precise skill that needs to be developed in a person's life, well, it takes time and effort and patience and perseverance. No pain, no gain. But the inevitable suffering of Jesus and disciples and the church is deeper than that. It's deeper than that. Jesus, we're reminded, by triple predictions in the Gospels, Jesus faced opposition. He faced opposition from the religious leaders in Jerusalem because he wanted and did love people into wholeness. And when they were loved into wholeness, they were changed. And the religious leadership didn't like they wanted the status quo. This was dangerous, and they decided he had to be eliminated. So he faced opposition from religious leadership in Jerusalem. But he also faced opposition, as we hear a moment ago, from his own disciples. From his own disciples. And it could well have been that Judas thought he was going to precipitate something wonderful by handing him over to the authorities, thought that at that moment the glory and everything would burst out and it would be the final triumph of everything good and decent. He might have thought that. And we know what happened. Or even Peter, as we hear in the Gospel, says, "Oh no, Lord, that's not going to." I couldn't imagine anything but power and glory and success. And we also another story. James and John, sons of Zebedee, had their mother come and say, I want a place on each side for the banquet. It's that temptation that doesn't want to face the reality that some profound things cost something. Today, those forces of opposition to the true vocation of Jesus that came at his time from the religious leadership and from his own disciples, they can also continue to come from the heart of the church, from people who just don't understand what I call the paschal imperative, that we have to suffer in order to rise. And that we have to suffer from doing the right thing, for doing the right thing, in order to rise victorious. Church is always tempted to align herself with power and wealth. We think of the fascist governments in Central and South America. It was during the Second Vatican Council that this preferential option for the poor was developed in order to say that's not where the church should be. Though it may be beneficial in a very, very superficial way. That's not where the church should be. And people were put to death in Central America and South America for saying the right thing that was not popular. Social teaching. John Paul II said it's constitutive to what the church is. It's easy to go along for comfort and convenience, but it's not the right thing sometimes. There's a question that has been developed for confirmation retreats, for examination of conscience. And the question is a very good one, especially for teenagers when there's that sense of peer identification that's so terribly important. The question is, when's the last time I did the right thing, even if it wasn't popular? When's the last time? But that isn't just for teenagers, it's for all of us. It's for the moment when we stand at the cooler, at the office, or in the locker room, or wherever, when we're in a banter of people around us, and we know in the depth of our heart that what they're saying isn't right, and we're not sure we have the courage to say so. I mean, that's a reality. It's the whole church, it's any one of us. And so we come to this gospel, and we recognize that Jesus said it's important to suffer for the right thing in order to be purified and to know that we are absolutely dependent upon God. Not upon ourselves, but upon God. And so spiritual writers will point out that sooner or later in every single person's life, there is a moment when we recognize we cannot do this by ourselves. And you know, it could be a little glass of brandy that we end up saying, that's stronger than I am. Or it could be some serious illness that just brings us to our knees. Or it could be betrayal of some kind or public embarrassment. Or when you speak the truth and not everybody wants to hear the truth. At the same time, we live in hope. Jeremiah, that very strong initial reading in which he accused God of seducing him, and there was a sexual undercurrent to those words. That's the same Jeremiah who, a little later in his life, with the Babylonians surrounding the city of Jerusalem, breaking down the walls, Jeremiah goes out and buys land in the suburbs because he wants to know and to signal that there is hope through whatever comes. He buys land in the suburbs, for pity's sake, because he knows that he lives in hope, that God is the source of his hope. So all of us, we live. The Paschal implication is that there is this reality that leads us through into something, we believe that, something bigger and better. And so Paul to the Romans, don't be conformed to this world. It's passing away. But rather, be formed to the renewal of your mind in the new creation and speak truth and justice and everything else that is important to say, and know that God brings good things from all of those experiences. That's the Paschal imperative. And that's good news.